Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, state-sponsored eugenics for fun and profit. It's closer than you think. I hope you'll stay tuned. If I knew more history, I wouldn't have been so surprised. But I was surprised. In June 2019, the outgoing president of the University of Vermont apologized for the university's role in promoting eugenics in Vermont. From 1925 to 1936, the university's professor Henry F. Perkins founded and ran the so-called Eugenics Survey of Vermont. Fans of eugenics sought to improve the human species by identifying so-called defective people and discouraging them from breeding. You could discourage breeding by stigmatizing allegedly defective people, or by institutionalizing them, or by sterilizing them, thus improving the gene pool of the human race, or at least of Vermont. The Eugenics Survey of Vermont sent researchers into the countryside. Of course, almost all of Vermont was countryside. Anyway, the researchers conducted a sort of census, and they categorized the supposed genetic defects they found. Here are some of the categories of defect they used: illiterate, illegitimate, insane, thief, queer, pauper, immoral, dishonest, rapist, sex offender, untruthful, epileptic, speech defect, just not right, hair lip, a little odd, sloppy, light-fingered, smoked or chewed at age 12, one-eyed, poor memory, breach of peace, shiftless, and degenerate. I know what you're thinking. That sounds like my in-laws. A striking thing about the whole eugenics movement is that, 85 years ago, very little was known about human genetics. That didn't stop them. A second thing is all kinds of quirks, rude behaviors, petty crimes, matters of culture, and medical conditions were all blithely attributed to genetic defects. Third, needless to say, it was only among the lower social classes that recorders found all these supposed defects. If you had a poor memory, a bad eye, told a few lies, and your last name was Vanderbilt or Lowell or Bush, not to worry. But if your last name was Bourgeois or Kallikak, you might find yourself denied a marriage license, put on a list of defectives, confined to an institution, and or forcibly sterilized. Vermont passed a forced sterilization law in 1931 and kept it on the books till the 1960s. Vermont forcibly sterilized 253 people. Vermont, that bastion of Yankee independence, keeping the government off your back, rugged individualism, rural virtues, and the Republican Party. Vermont, et in Arcadia ego, as they used to say. In the U.S., eugenics is no longer respectable and fashionable, ever since Adolf Hitler came out as the movement's biggest admirer. The term is no longer used, but the ideas are still with us. Racism seems to be a version of eugenics. The white nationalist and anti-immigrant movements seem strongly connected to eugenics. And eugenics is strongly connected to capitalism. Scott Noble's fine film, Human Resources, explores these connections well. When we serialized this film on our show last year, we omitted the section on two semi-scientific movements that were very useful in controlling uppity workers. These two movements were behaviorist psychology, as promoted by J.B. Watson and B.F. Skinner, and eugenics. Let's hear part of that section now. Here is Human Resources.
Metanoia Films, in association with I Am the Mob, presents Human Resources.
Give me a baby, and I can make any kind of man. These are the words of John B. Watson, the founder of behaviorism. According to this worldview, the behavior of organisms, including human beings, is predictable and therefore controllable. In 1920, at Johns Hopkins University, Watson experimented on several babies ranging in age from 3 months to a year. The experiments were remarkable in their simplicity. He would present a candle to infants to see if they were afraid of fire. He would introduce animals to their environment to see if the children were afraid of them naturally, or only after a traumatic experience. He would make a hissing noise and observe the results. Watson learned that newborn babies had no fear of the dark. He also learned, however, that such fear could be conditioned. And so it was with rabbits. This baby, known as Little Albert, initially found delight in touching a rabbit. Yet, as Watson began to clang a steel rod and claw a hammer behind the child's head whenever he touched the creature, the reaction became not one of delight, but terror. Soon, the mere sight of the rabbit would elicit fear, even when no noise was provided, a fear that also extended to objects and textures of a similar type. From his experiments, Watson reached a radical conclusion which would come to define political and social engineering in the 20th century. The driving force in society, he claimed, is not love, but fear.
L.J. Henderson, Harvard University. If people do the right thing, they don't need to be retrained. Rebecca Lemo, author of World as Laboratory.
You could speculate about why the rat was so useful. I mean, one thing, it reproduced really fast. Another thing is that people were not affectionate towards rats, so you didn't really need to worry about ethical objections unless something truly horrible was done. And finally, I guess you could see the rat as a metaphor for an animal that is tractable. Running a rat through a maze, it's a pretty understandable metaphor for most of us of running through life. And in fact, if you look at the history of the maze, it goes back through early Christian and even into Greek societies as kind of a metaphor for life. The idea that you somehow wind your way through a maze. Of course, in the Christian tradition, the maze is full of meaning and you're eventually trying to get to God. It's kind of a pilgrim's progress. Whereas in modern society, people like Nietzsche said that, you know, life was like a maze that you could never run to the end of. But in the 20th century, in American laboratories, the maze was once again adopted as a symbol of hope, not a hope that one could get to God or get to a meaningful life, but the hope that people could actually be controlled in a very scientific manner, that social life could be remade on the basis of scientific principles.
In the roll call of scientific pioneers, few names will summon the passionate controversy as that which surrounds B.F. Skinner. His work has led to the formulation of the science of human behavior, which finds behavior to be predictable, therefore controllable. And for this, he has been both applauded and attacked. The science of behavior is based on the principles of operant conditionings. These principles and their practice have recently become known as behavior modification, sacrilege to some because it has to do with methods by which man can shape the behavior of others. But far from being a scheme to control people without their knowledge, it allows man to study and analyze behavior and to apply its healing potential to such fields as education, medicine, and psychology.
George Ritzer, author of The McDonaldization of Society.
Behaviorism, as it suggests, is the study of behavior. It's the notion that really all that matters is behavior and not the thought processes that lie behind behavior. And it also is very much a method of control. In behaviorism, there's the whole idea of behavior modification, where you can use various kinds of techniques to modify people's behaviors so that they stop doing what you don't want them to do and they start doing what you want them to do. So I think it's the scientific aspect of it and the controlling aspect of it that defines behaviorism.
The philosophy of behaviorism is deceptively simple. It suggests that organisms can be viewed as flesh and blood machines. Like machines, we require fuel. Like machines, we can be put to work for a specific cause. Like machines, we can be repaired or redesigned for new purposes. And like machines, we can be compelled into performing a certain action at the push of a button. The science of human behavior had always intrigued philosophers, but it wasn't until the Enlightenment and the era of capitalist industrialization that men began to think that they could control life forms in the same way they controlled objects.
Maurice Berman, author of The Reenchantment of the World.
Prior to that, when we think of the Middle Ages, even much of the Renaissance, the idea was that things were interrelated. They were organically a whole. In that sense, the Middle Ages had a lot in common with traditional peasant or folk cultures around the world. Things are seen as basically being a kind of giant web of influence. Everything was like a chain where if you plucked one part, the other part would resonate. That was the previous view, a worldview that had great advantages and also great disadvantages. With the scientific revolution in the 17th century, that view altered, in which things were seen as mechanical parts that interrelated. The mechanical philosophy of the 17th century was a very crucial step in the rise of capitalism, because capitalism does that. For example, it sees the earth at a distance. It sees the earth as something to be mined and exploited. It sees the earth as dead. So capitalism and the mechanical philosophy went together very well. And that, in many ways, made possible the Industrial Revolution, the rise of modernity. And there again, we can say there are great advantages to it and also great disadvantages to it. Civilizations usually come as a package deal. There's a light side and a dark side. Every civilization believes in its own propaganda, so it tends to emphasize the light side and forgets about the shadows.
For the behaviorist, it started with plants. Julius Sachs at the University of Würzburg enumerated a set of tropisms, defined as any directed response by an organism to a constant stimulus. An example is the way an ivy plant will turn its leaves toward the window in order to gain exposure to sunlight. Sachs' protege, Jacques Loeb, took it to the next level by creating a stable of insects he called durable machines. In his laboratory at the University of Chicago, he trained cockroaches through the use of simple tropisms. Because of the insect's bilateral symmetry, a light shone on one side caused it to move in the other direction. In Russia, Ivan Pavlov moved on to animals. The term Pavlov dog has become synonymous with the conditioned reflex. Pavlov discovered that a dog would salivate when it began to associate a stimulus, such as a ringing bell, with food. In America, John B. Watson finally graduated to human beings.
John Watson was an extremely interesting character in the history of American social science and also the history of American advertising, which is a not insignificant connection between the two. His dissertation in 1906 was about the kinesthetics of the rat as it navigated a maze, and his idea was that he could remove one by one the senses of a rat, like remove its ability to see, remove its ability to hear, its ability to feel, and then see whether the rat could still make its way through a maze that it had been trained to navigate. So in his mind, rats were always stand-ins for human beings and human subjects. He called it psychology as the behaviorist views it, and it was basically his manifesto for behaviorism. And in it, he declared that behaviorism was a science of human behavior and that there was a method available to make a technology by which human beings could be shaped in any way that a scientist desired. Watson always was interested in control. One finds this theme throughout his work. He said, "Give me a baby and I can make any kind of man."
Watson continued to experiment on babies and other living things until his star began to fade. At the end of his life, he wrote nostalgically of his failure to put together what he considered the ultimate experiment in social engineering, a multi-ethnic baby farm. "I sometimes think I regret," Watson wrote, "that I could not have a group of infant farms where I could have brought up 30 pure-blooded Negroes on one, 30 pure-blooded Anglo-Saxons on another, and 30 Chinese on a third, all under similar conditions." Watson's dream may seem bizarre to modern ears, but implicit in the concept was a real desire to see the question of race answered once and for all. He was not unlike thousands of other researchers at prestigious universities across the United States.
Sharon Smith, historian.
In the late 19th century, alongside the rise of Jim Crow segregation in the 1890s, what you saw is that corporations developed a much more elaborate way to justify the fact that the wealthy corporate elite, which was without exception white, to explain the reason why. That reason has its basis in what became known as the eugenics movement. You were born with either good genes or not good genes.
The 1934 film, Tomorrow's Children.
"In the case of Miss Mason, I can see no reason for the operation that's been recommended. The girl is perfectly normal. She's hardworking and has a good reputation."
"Do you know anything about her family background?"
"Well, yes, Your Honor, I do."
"There are several other children, aren't there?"
"Yes."
"What is their condition?"
"One is a cripple. Two others might be classed as feeble-minded."
"Isn't the oldest son in jail?"
"Well, yes, I believe so."
"And knowing all that, you still contend that this girl should be allowed to bring more people like that into the world?"
"Those who have good genes should be encouraged to reproduce, and those who are, quote, unfit should be discouraged from reproducing, from having children." That eventually went into forced sterilization programs, which started in the United States, directed against African Americans, Native Americans, immigrants in particular.
Justin Jacko, author of No One is Illegal.
Eugenics was a pseudoscience rooted in the idea that you can, A, recognized pre-biologically determined differences in people based on their ethnicity, and that B, you could construct a policy that favors some ethnic groups over others, both in terms of immigration policy and in terms of integration into U.S. society based on this hierarchy of heredity. This pseudoscience, this philosophy, gained a lot of traction in the United States amongst the industrialist class, especially at a time when immigrant workers, who made up a large percentage, if not the majority of workers at the turn of the 20th century, were beginning to form unions, were beginning to create collective organizations, their own political parties, to challenge the conditions of industrialization, which were horrific and oppressive. It took root in the universities. It took root amongst the highest offices of government. Calvin Coolidge, for instance, Republican president, believed that, and even stated his belief that a lot of social problems were associated with inferior races. We see ultimately this philosophy is going to play an important role in shaping immigration policy after the passage of the Immigration Act of 1924, which essentially creates a national quota system that favors immigrants based on their ethnicity and based on their nationality.
One fact that is important to understand about the eugenics movement is that it was created and funded by the corporate elites that ruled America coming into the 20th century. It was the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Kellogg family of the cereal. They funded these research programs at universities. All of it created, funded by these corporate families. The Rockefellers, in particular, played a particularly devious role. As the eugenics movement developed, it went in a really horrible direction.
We humans have transgressed the law of natural selection in the last few decades. We have supported inferior life forms that looked like this picture of inferior looking Jew. The Black Stork, 1917, an American pro-eugenics film featuring a poor, bewildered looking mother and an authoritative, trustworthy doctor. It's a black and white silent movie, of course. The screen cuts to explanatory text. His blood is tainted through inheritance. I believe it wrong to operate to prolong an absolutely useless life.
The Rockefellers would play a key role in the advancement of social engineering in the years between the Great Wars. Between 1922 and 1929, an arm of the Rockefeller Foundation gave out almost $50 million toward the pursuit of the social sciences around the world. According to historian Judith C. Lander, the spur was a need for better organization in society at large. What had begun as a public relations ploy to assuage public anger in the face of unscrupulous business practices and violent suppression of working people, the Rockefeller charities would set out to change society as a whole.
Rebecca Lemmon, author of World as Laboratory.
The Yale Institute of Human Relations was founded in 1929. It was given us $7 million initially from the Rockefeller Foundation just a couple of months before Black Tuesday occurred in October of 1929. So according to my calculations, if you factor in all the money that Rockefeller eventually gave the Yale Institute and the other monies from the government, this was the largest social science project that's ever been funded in history.
And here we must pause Scott Noble's fine documentary film, Human Resources. That's available free on the internet. My facts on the Eugenics Survey of Vermont are from a nice article by Joanna Tebbs Young, published in the Rutland Reader in 2014. Thanks to all. Let's end with a bit of history by singer David Rovix. We noted that the most famous fan of the American eugenics movement was Adolf Hitler. Hitler also admired America's race-based immigration laws and also the Jim Crow laws in the South. Eugenics was a cornerstone of the Third Reich. Full-fledged genocide was not a feature of early Nazi ideology, but it developed during the course of the war. The genetic superiority of the so-called Aryan race was a feature from the beginning. You'll recall that Hitler aimed to purify the Reich by exterminating not only the Jews, but also the so-called gypsies and the homosexuals. Vermont's eugenics survey paid particular attention to the state's gypsy families, and it classified all homosexual people as defective. The distance is not terribly large, from state-ordered sterilization to state-run extermination camps. David Rovix sings about a truly fine incident in European history. Some background. Germany invaded Denmark in 1940. Danish troops put up only token resistance. The country quickly capitulated, cooperated with Germany, and was allowed to maintain a degree of independence. But by 1943, the thousand-year Reich was looking dubious. Denmark had about 7,800 Jews. In October 1943, Hitler ordered that they all be deported to concentration camps. The Danish resistance movement, plus hundreds of ordinary Danish fishermen, launched a massive rescue operation. They ferried about 8,000 people, 7,220 Jews, plus 686 non-Jewish spouses, ferried them across the Kattegat Sea to safety in neutral Sweden. Thanks to them, 99% of Denmark's Jews survived the Holocaust. This rescue operation is a stunning example of ordinary people taking collective action by themselves to fight oppression. You can see why the U.S. corporate media is hoping you'll never hear of it. The powers that be are pleased to celebrate the wealthy capitalist good guy Oskar Schindler. Hundreds of common Danish fishermen, forget it. The corporate media hope you'll never hear of that incident. David Rovics hopes otherwise. We'll end the show with Rovics. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and see you next week. Here is David Rovics with a song called Denmark 1943.
When we heard the news, we were to be arrested. We had no doubt exactly what our fate would be. We had hours to get out, only hours to be tested for 5,000 people to cross the Baltic Sea. We had to go at night in the cover of the darkness. There's no way I could exaggerate the threat. We tried not to make a sound, wore nothing that would mark us, but no one knew how far across we'd get. And I thank God for the fishermen who gave us a ride and took us over to the other side. To find so many boats ready for the journey, to find so many prepared to risk it all. Not everyone could read the stars, not every boat was worthy, not everyone prepared to heed the call. But I thank God for the fishermen who gave us a ride and took us over to the other side. Some risked everything for free, accepting nothing but a handshake. Some charged enough to live on for a year. But such details don't matter when so much is at stake, when all that matters is a boat that you might steer. We lived out the war in Sweden while so many others didn't, and most people now would easily agree. To say we deserved asylum would simply be redundant in the boat lift of 1943. And I thank God for the fishermen who gave us a ride and took us over to the other side. I thank God for the fishermen who gave us a ride and took us over to the other side. And took us over to the other side. And took us over to the other side, and took us over to the other side.